The answer to the fourth question is that the issue of abrogation or limiting of the Quran by the Hadith has arisen out of a lack of proper understanding and enough deliberation. In reality, no Hadith has abrogated a Quranic verse or limited its scope of application, and thus there arises no doubt from this angle on the status of the Quran as the Furqan and the Mizan. When people were not able to understand certain stylistic features of the Quran and the background and perspective of certain verses, they were also not able to understand the words of the Prophet ﷺ regarding these areas. All examples which are presented in this regard are of this type. The chain of narrations of some of these narratives have flaws. However, since they are often presented, in the following pages, we shall take up each of these examples, disregarding these flaws, and present our view on them. Of the animals which God has created on this earth, some are meant to be eaten and others are not. Since these latter type of animals, if eaten, affect the tazkiyah, or spiritual purification of a person, an aversion to them is found in his nature. Generally, human nature provides a person with ample guidance in this matter, and without any hesitation, he is able to decide the right course. He very well knows that lions, tigers, elephants, eagles, crows, vultures, kites, snakes, scorpions, and human flesh itself are not meant to be eaten. He is also well aware of the fact that horses and mules are a means of transportation and have no role in satisfying one's hunger. That feces and urine of animals are impure things is known to him very well also. No doubt, at times, human nature becomes perverted, but a study of human behavior shows that a great majority of people does not generally falter in this matter. It is for this reason that the Sharia has not given any original guidance on this matter, and after stressing that everything appropriate for eating, tayyibat, is allowed and everything inappropriate for eating, khabaith, is prohibited, it has left the matter to human nature to decide. Consequently, the Sharia has provided guidance on animals and on things related to animals in which it was difficult for man purely on the basis of his intellect and nature to decide the right course. The pig is a quadrupled beast of the same genre as the goat, sheep, cow, and cattle. However, it consumes meat like other carnivores. Should it then be considered forbidden or not? Should animals which are slaughtered in a way that all their blood is not drained out be eaten or not? Is the blood of such animals impure, as indeed are their feces and urine? If animals are slaughtered by taking the name of someone other than the Almighty, can they still be eaten? Since man is unable to come up with a decisive answer in these issues, therefore the Almighty guided mankind in this affair through his prophets and informed them that the flesh of the pig, blood, meat of dead animals, and animals which are slaughtered in the name of someone other than Allah are also impure and unclean, and therefore people should abstain from them. In this regard, these aforementioned four things have been primarily discussed by the Sharia. The Quran, at some places by using the linguistic expressions, "I do not find anything forbidden in what God has revealed to me," and at some places the expression "only and only," has unequivocally stated that only and only these four things are prohibited by the Almighty. It is stated in Surah Baqarah, "Believers, eat of the wholesome things with which we have provided you, and be grateful to God, and be grateful to God alone, if it is Him you worship. He has forbidden you only carrion, blood, and the flesh of swine, also any flesh that is slaughtered in the name of someone other than God." Surah 2, verses 172 to 173. It is stated in Surah An-Nam, "Say, I find not in what has been revealed to me through inspiration forbidden to a person who eats things which are edible, unless it be carrion, or blood poured forth, or the flesh of swine, because all these are unclean, or in disobedience to Allah, animals slaughtered in someone else's name." Surah 6, verse 145. It is reported in certain narratives that the Prophet ﷺ has prohibited the meat of beasts having sharp canine teeth, birds having claws and tentacles in their feet, and tame donkeys. It is evident from the above discussion that this is merely a delineation of the innate guidance found within human nature. P. people have erroneously regarded this delineation of divine guidance as Sharia, even though it has no link with the prohibition of the Sharia stated in the Quran. Thus, the issue of hadith abrogating the Quran does not even arise here. One salient feature of the language of the Quran is that the meanings which are understood of their own accord because of the presence of other words and indicators, or because of some logical obviousness, are not expressed in words. Complements of oaths, answer to conditional statements, parallel clauses of a sentence, and the copulative sentence of a conditional sentence are often suppressed. In Surah 4 verse 11, for example, there is an ellipsis of the word two before more than two, and for the father two-thirds, after and for the mother one-third, and for the father after and for the mother one-sixth, or words of similar meaning. Similarly, an ellipsis of the copulative sentence of "and that you deal with the orphans with justice" has occurred in Surah 4 verse 127. As another example, consider the following verse: "And all the beasts that roam in the earth on their feet, and all the birds that fly on their wings in the sky with both their wings, are but communities like your own." Surah 6 verse 38. A little deliberation shows that in the above verse, an ellipsis of parallel phrases has occurred. Because of the presence of the expression "in the earth" in the first part of the sentence, there is an ellipsis of its parallel expression "in the sky" in the second part. Similarly, because of the presence of the expression "fly on their wings" in the second part of the sentence, an ellipsis of its parallel expression "roam on their legs" has occurred in the first part of the sentence. Though this style is not present in the English language, it exists abundantly in classical Arabic. In Surah Nisa, where the Quran has mentioned women with whom marriage is prohibited, two instances of this style can be seen. The Quran says, "And marry not your mothers who have suckled you and your sisters through fosterage." Surah 4 verse 23. "And also two sisters in wedlock at the same time, except for what has already happened." Surah 4 verse 23. In the first directive, together with foster mothers, foster sisters are also regarded as relations prohibited for marriage. Had the directive ended with foster mothers, nothing further could have been understood from it. However, if the relationship of fosterage with a mother makes her daughter a foster sister, then it is but logical to regard other relations of the foster mother to be also included in this directive. If being suckled through the same mother can make someone a foster sister, why can't the sister of the foster mother be regarded as the maternal aunt, her husband as the father, the sister of her husband as the paternal aunt, her daughter's daughter, and her son's daughter as nieces? Hence, it is obvious that all these relations are also prohibited in marriage. This indeed is the purport of the Book of God, and the words testify to it. It is evident to any knowledgeable person who deliberates on these words. Same is the case with the second directive. If combining two sisters in wedlock is a lewd thing, as far as the relationship of marriage is concerned, then combining a lady with her brother's daughter in wedlock, or with her sister's daughter in wedlock, is like combining a mother and a daughter in wedlock. Hence, regardless of the words used, the purport of the Quran no doubt actually is, "And two sisters in wedlock at the same time, and a lady with her brother's daughter at the same time, and a lady with her sister's daughter at the same time." However, all these words are suppressed because what is mentioned points towards this suppression as obviously understood. So obvious are the words of this suppression that no student of the Quran can err in understanding them. The Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said, "Every relationship which is prohibited for marriage owing to lineage is also prohibited owing to fosterage." Neither can a lady and her paternal aunt, nor can a lady and her maternal aunt be combined in wedlock. Reference Malik al-Muwatta, 341, number 1600. These narratives of the Prophet ﷺ only explain the Quranic verses referred to above and in no way alter or add to them. Verses 11 and 12 of Surah Nisa mention the distribution of inheritance of a deceased. While mentioning the shares of various heirs, the Almighty has subtly alluded to the fact that the basis on which a person has the right to inherit from a deceased is his own benefit to him. "You know not who among your children and parents are nearest to you in benefit. This is the law of God. Indeed, God is wise and all-knowing." Surah 4 verse 11. This benefit is by nature present in parents, children, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, and other close relations. Hence, in normal circumstances, they will be considered the heirs to the legacy of a deceased. However, in certain unusual circumstances, if an absence of benefit in any of these relationships is diagnosed by sense and reason, then the style and pattern of the verse demands that such a relative should not become an heir to the legacy. This exception, a little deliberation would show, has not been created from some external source. On the contrary, it was present in the directive at its very inception. Hence, if a scholar of the Quran refers to it, he would not be changing or altering the meaning of the divine book. It would be perfectly in accordance with the purport of the verse, to which its words so clearly testify. In view of this, the Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said about the idolaters and the people of the Book of Arabia, "A Muslim cannot be an heir to a kafir, nor can a kafir be a Muslim's." In other words, after the Quraysh and the people of the Book were left with no excuse to deny the truth, which had been conclusively communicated to them in its ultimate form, their enmity and hostility became very clear. Consequently, the benefit of kinship between them and the Muslims stood completely severed. Hence, they could not inherit from one another. In Surah Maidah, Surah 5, verses 33-34, the four punishments prescribed for criminals who spread nuisance and anarchy in the society are taqtil, or killing someone in an exemplary manner, taslib, crucifixion, amputating limbs from opposite sides, and exile. Consequently, the Prophet ﷺ in his times included prostitutes in the application of this directive and is reported to have said, "Acquire it from me. The Almighty has revealed a way for these women. In such criminals, the unmarried men will be treated in the same way as the unmarried women, and their punishment is 100 stripes and exile, and similarly, married men and married women shall be treated in the same way, and their punishment is 100 stripes and death by stoning." Reference Muslim Al-Jami Al-Sahih 749, number 4414. His view was that since such women were not merely guilty of fornication, but were also guilty of spreading anarchy and nuisance in the society, as they had adopted profligacy as a way of life, those among them who deserved any mitigation should be administered the punishments of 100 stripes, according to verse 2 of Surah Nur, because of committing fornication and exiled, according to verse 33 of Surah Maidah, to protect the society from their dissolute practices. And those among them who did not deserve any leniency should be stoned to death according to the directive of taqtil of the same verse of Surah Maidah. This directive of the Prophet ﷺ, it is evident, does not in any way change the purport of the Quran. Mita, or meat of dead animals, is one of the things which the Almighty has regarded as forbidden. A person who is conversant with the linguistic features of Arabic knows that this word has a literal meaning, and it also has a meaning which emanates from its linguistic usage. In the first case, it means everything which is dead. However, in the second case, one who is aware of the intricacies of the Arabic language will, for example, never include dead fish or dead locust in its connotation. The Prophet ﷺ on these very grounds is reported to have said, "Two types of dead and two forms of blood are not forbidden for us, the former being fish and locust, and the latter being liver and spleen." Reference Abu Bakr Ahmad ibn al-Husayn al-Bihaqi, Al-Sunan al-Kubra, Volume 1. Al-Zamakhshari, an authority in linguistics, writes, "Then if you ask the question, among the dead there are some things which are allowed to us, like the fish and locust, and the Prophet ﷺ has said, 'Two types of dead and two forms of blood are allowed to us,' I will say in response, 'The word mita mentioned in the Quran must be understood according to its linguistic usage.' Is not the case that when someone says that he has eaten mita, we never include a fish or a locust in its connotation? This is similar to the fact that if a person says that he has drunk blood, we never include liver or spleen in its connotation. Precisely because of such usage, jurists say that if a person swears that he will never eat meat and then he consumes fish, this will not break his oath, although in reality he has eaten meat. The punishment for theft is mentioned in the Quran in the following words, 'And as to the thief, male or female, cut off their hands as a reward of their own deeds, and as an exemplary punishment from God, For God is mighty and wise. Surah 5 verse 38. It is evident from this verse that the punishment of amputating the hands is prescribed for a thief, both male, or sariq, or female, sariqa. Every scholar of the Arabic language knows that the words sariq and sariqa are adjectives and denote thoroughness and completeness in the characteristics of the verb they qualify. Consequently, they can only be used for the type of sarqa which can be called a theft, and the one who commits it can be called a thief. In other words, if a child steals a few rupees from his father's pocket, or a wife pinches some money from her husband, or if a person steals something very ordinary, or plucks some fruit from his neighbor's orchard, or carries away something valuable, which has been left unprotected, or drives away an unattended grazing animal, or commits this ignoble offense owing to some need or compulsion, then no doubt all these are unworthy acts and should be punished, but certainly they cannot be classified as acts of theft which the above given verse qualifies. The narrative of the Prophet ﷺ, which is generally presented in this regard, is only an explanation of this purport of the Quran and does not modify it in the slightest way. If a fruit is hanging from a tree, or a goat is grazing on a mountainside, and someone steals them, then hands should not be amputated for this. But if the goat comes in a penfold, and the fruit is stacked in a field, then hands should be amputated on the condition that the fruit or the goat are at least the price of a shield. Reference Malik al-Muwatta 545, number 2594. Parallel verses and constructions. The Quran presents its message in various ways and in a variety of styles. As a result, it has become unparalleled among other works in explaining its own verses, which are set in a very concise diction and which are inimitable. Thus, it introduces itself as follows. God has revealed the best of discourses whose verses resemble one another and whose surahs occur in pairs. Surah 39, verse 23. Verses such as, "And we have explained in various ways our revelations in this Quran so that they may take heed." Surah 17, verse 41. Bring to light this very characteristic of the Quran by the word tasrif. This word literally means to circulate and pass around. In other words, presenting the same thing in various ways and in diverse styles. This is a book whose verses were first concise and then they were explained from him who is wise and all-knowing. Surah 11, verse 1. Thus initially, the style adopted was concise, brief, and succinct. And later, the succinct verses which carried a world of meaning were explained. While explaining this characteristic of the Quran, Imam Amin Ehsan Islahi writes, "If you read the Quran, you realize that the same topic appears in various surahs. A novice may regard this as mere repetition. However, those who deliberate on the Quran know that it does not contain any repetition. A topic which appears at other places also does not appear with the same background and context. These are different at different places. The variations depend on the place and placement of the topic under discussion. At one place, an aspect would be hidden, while at another, it would be revealed. Similarly, at one place, the real direction of address may be unspecified, and at another context, it becomes specified. In fact, my years of personal experience is that at one place a word appears to be unclear, and at another place, its meaning becomes very clear. Similarly, at one place, the argument of some premise may not be understood. However, at another place, it becomes as clear as the sun. This style adopted by the Quran is to imprint its message on the reader. Consequently, it is to express gratitude to the Almighty that I mention the fact that in order to overcome the difficulties of the Quran, the extent of help I have received from the Quran itself is emulated by no other source. The beauty of the Quranic message itself entails that it should be read in various styles. If a person has a keen mind, the exquisite variations in presenting the same fact help him in absorbing it in some way or the other. Amin Ehsan Islahi, Tadabbur-i-Quran, Volume 1, page 28. These are the words and first-hand experience of the greatest scholar of the Quran in contemporary times after the great Hamid al-Din al-Farahi. Any student of the Quran who deliberates on the Quran will find this reality stamped on every page of it. Thus, it must be accepted as a principle that the Quran explains itself. This principle holds good not only for the directives of the Quran, the historical references it cites, and other allusions it makes, but also for the invaluable treasure of the parallels of its own words and style, so that difficulties encountered in understanding them can be resolved by recourse to this treasure. Imam Amin Ehsan Islahi writes, "It is not possible to present the details here. Otherwise, I could have shown how the Quran takes a word from the common spoken Arabic language and incorporates loftier meanings in it than its conventionally understood one. Not only this, the variation in which it would use this word and the aura it would create for it would be enough to fully guide and satisfy a student of the Quran about its usage and other minute details without making him to resort to elaborate Arabic lexicons, like the Lisan and the Siha. This characteristic of the Quran can be observed not only in words, but also with the styles it adopts and the grammatical constructions it contains. The constructions which have become very difficult for the grammarians of the Quran to comprehend have been explained and corroborated by the Quran at other places by variation in usage to the extent that one becomes fully certain of their implications." Amin Ehsan Islahi, Mabadi Tadabbari Quran, page 60. The Final Book on Religion. The Quran is last and final and not the first book of the religion it presents. The history of this religion is that when God created man on this earth, the basic realities of religion were ingrained in man's nature. He was then communicated the following things through his earliest ancestor Adam sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Firstly, he has a creator who created him. He alone is his Lord. And as a natural corollary to this, he alone should be worshipped by him. Secondly, he has been sent in this world to be tried and tested. And for this, he has been given a clear awareness of good and evil. He has not only been given the freedom to exercise his will, he has also been given sovereignty on this earth. This trial of his will continue till his death. If he is successful in this trial, he will be given the kingdom of heaven, where he will be free from the regrets of the past and the fears of the future. Thirdly, the Almighty at various times will keep sending his guidance according to man's needs. If he obeys this guidance, he will not go astray. And if he evades it, he will be eternally doomed in the hereafter. Consequently, the Almighty fulfilled his promise and provided guidance to mankind by selecting people from among them and through them delivered his guidance to mankind. This guidance contained both al-hikmah and al-sharia. The former obviously did not require any change, while the latter was revealed as per the needs of a people until the time of Abraham sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when its directives crystallized in the form of a sunnah for all mankind. In the time of Moses sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when a formal state of the Israelites had been established, the Torah was revealed and directives of the Sharia regarding the collectivity were also revealed. During this time, when certain aspects of hikmah did not remain before the eyes of people, they were made evident to them through the Psalms and Gospels. When the original texts of these scriptures became extinct, the Almighty sent the last of his messengers and gave him the Quran. "And O Prophet, we have revealed to you the book with the truth in confirmation of the Sharia before it, and standing as a guardian over it. Therefore give judgment among these people of the book, according to the guidance revealed by God, and do not yield to their whims by swerving from the truth revealed to you. For each of you, we have ordained a Sharia and assigned a path. And had God pleased, he could have made of you one community. But it is his wish to try you by that which he has bestowed upon you. So, compete with each other in good deeds. To God shall you return. Then he shall disclose upon you all your differences." Surah 5, verse 48. This is the history of religion. Consequently, keeping it in consideration, the following precede the Quran. Innate guidance found in human nature. The tradition of the religion of Abraham sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The scriptures of the prophets. The first of the above mentioned things relates to the basics of faith and morality. In the terminology of the Quran, a major portion of this is called maruf and munkar. The former refers to things which are regarded to be good by human nature, and the latter refers to things which are regarded to be evil by it and which are abhorred by it. The Quran does not give a comprehensive list of these things. On the other hand, it says that a person is innately aware of these and is able to fully distinguish between the two on this basis. It thus demands that a person accept maruf and shun munkar. And true believers, both men and women, are friends to one another. They urge one another to what is good and forbid what is evil. Surah 9, verse 71. The second of the above mentioned things is called Milate Ibrahimi by the Quran. The prayer, the fast, the Hajj, and the Zakah are all directives of this Minhat-e Ibrahimi. The addressees of the Quran were fully aware of them, and to a great extent practiced them the way they were. In the narrative which depicts Abu Dharr's radiallahu ta'ala anhu acceptance of faith, he explicitly says that he would diligently offer the prayer even before Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam had declared his prophethood. Reference Muslim, Al-Jami' al-Sahi, pages 1086 to 1088. It is known that the Friday prayer was not unknown to the addressees of the Quran. Reference Muhammad ibn Mukarram ibn Manzur, Lisan al-Arab, volume 8, page 58. They would offer the funeral prayer. Reference Jawad Ali, Al-Mufassal fi Tariq al-Arab qabl al-Islam, 2nd edition, volume 6, page 338, and would fast in the very manner we would fast today. Reference Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami' al-Sahi, 321, Muslim Al-Jami' al-Sahi, 460. Zakah too was known to them as a specific share in their wealth the way it is now. Reference the Quran, Surah 70, verse 24. Regarding the worship rituals of Hajj and Umrah, every knowledgeable person knows that though the Quraysh had added some religious innovations to them, the rites of these worship rituals which they offered were virtually the same as they are today. In fact, it is evident from certain narratives that people were even aware of these innovations. Consequently, there is a narrative both by Al-Bukhari and Muslim that the Hajj offered by Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam before his prophethood was offered without these innovations of the Quraysh in the very manner it was offered ever since the time of Abraham sallallahu alayhi wasallam. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami' al-Sahi 270, Muslim Al-Jami' al-Sahi 517. Same is the case with animal sacrifice, itikaf, circumcision, besides some other customs and etiquette of Islam. All these things were already known and specified, and the Arabs were aware of them as age-old traditions transferred by one generation to another. Thus, there was no need for the Quran to give their details. They fully knew what the Arabic words which referred to them meant. If the Quran asked them to pray and to fast and to offer the Hajj and to pay zakah, they fully knew what these terms meant. The Quran never gave them the first directive about these. It only reformed and revived them and explained some aspect, and that too to the extent of what was essential. This tradition of the religion of Abraham sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which in religious parlance is called Sunnah, is regarded by the Quran as the religion of God, and when it asks the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam to follow the religion of Abraham sallallahu alaihi wasallam, it indeed asks him to fully follow the Sunnah as well. Then we revealed to you to follow the ways of Abraham, who was true in faith and was not among the polytheists. Surah 16, verse 123. The third of these are the divine scriptures which are present in the Bible in the forms of the Torah, the Gospels, and the Psalms. Their recipients have lost parts of them to posterity, and have also been guilty of interpolations in them. However, still a rich treasure of the Sharia and Hikmah revealed by the Almighty is present in them in its vintage divine style. Students of the Quran know that it has referred to them at various places, has made concise allusions to the prophetic tales mentioned in them, and has negated the interpolations of the Jews and the Christians, and criticized the history presented in them. The Quran has based its Itmam al-Hujjah, communicating the truth to the extent that nobody has an excuse to deny it, on these very scriptures, and it unequivocally declares that its fountainhead and origin is the same as that of these scriptures. O Prophet! He has revealed to you the book with the truth, in confirmation of the scriptures which preceded it. And before this, he has already revealed the Torah and the Gospel for the guidance of mankind. And after them, revealed this Furqan. Indeed, those that deny God's revelations shall be sternly punished. And God is mighty and capable of retribution. Surah 3, verses 3-4. O Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we have sent revelations to you as we sent revelations to Noah and to the prophets who came after him, and as we sent revelations to Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, and his progeny, and to Jesus, Job, Jonah, Aaron, Solomon, and we gave the Psalms to David. Surah 4, verse 163. It is because of this background of the Quran that certain principles should be accepted in interpreting it. Firstly, the religion stands completed with the awareness of good and evil, which is found in human nature, and which the Quran calls maruf, or good, and munkar, or evil. This ma'ruf and munkar precede the directives and prohibitions of the sharia, which are prescribed in the Quran, and are the foundations on which the latter stand. Any concept of the sharia which is devoid of the good and evil found in human nature will definitely be defective and against the purport of the Quran. Secondly, the sunnah is not after the Quran, it precedes it historically. Hence, it shall necessarily be derived from the consensus and perpetual adherence of its adherents. The details of its directives mentioned in the Quran shall also be ascertained from this very consensus and perpetual adherence. They shall not be derived from the Quran the same way some scholars of contemporary times have done so, and in this manner grossly misinterpreted the Quran. Thirdly, in order to understand styles peculiar to divine literature, the history of the Jews and the Christians, and accounts of the Israelite prophets, and the allusions of the Quran to other similar topics, as well as the details of facts it briefly refers to, the real source are the previous scriptures. They shall be regarded as the basis of debate and discussion. In this regard, the narratives which have been recorded in various exegeses of the Quran, and which are mostly based on hearsay, shall be disregarded. These narratives cannot be a substitute to the light which ancient scriptures cast on these subjects, and the way the words of the Quran accept these details, or bring to surface the real facts about certain aspects mentioned in them. Such narratives neither satisfy the intellect of the students of the Quran, nor prove any worth as an argument for the people of the book.